From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins. Our guest on this edition of the program is Andrew Ferguson, author of the newly published book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. Andrew Ferguson is a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia here in Washington. In his new book, Andrew defines, categorizes, and helps us understand the transformation and digital deregulation of policing and its implications for liberty and security in the United States. The book shows how big data can help police solve crime and enhance police accountability and oversight. But it also exposes how the use of big data to inform policing practices can mask and reinforce racial bias under the cloak of objectivity. The book is very timely given the incidents of police brutality in recent years in the United States, in which blacks and minorities have been disproportionately targeted or killed by police, and the subsequent backlash against law enforcement. To what extent is technology changing American policing, and are the changes positive? Andrew is no stranger at these VOA microphones. He has also appeared on VOA's Encounter program, and we're delighted to welcome him now to the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. Andrew Ferguson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And congratulations on your book. Let's define some terms first, Andrew. When you talk about big data, please define the term and how it relates to policing.
Big data is all around us, right? We're constantly developing data trails where we are giving our information through credit cards, through the Internet of Things. And big data is a global term that sort of encompasses the fact that we are in a new world of data development where we have an increasing volume of data, increasing variety of data, and an increasing velocity of data. All of these sort of data trails are now being used by police. Police are trying to investigate. Police are trying to surveil communities. And new technologies are arising and developing that are changing how police, where they go, who they target, when they target, and how they target. And this change is affecting the daily lives of individuals on the streets of America and across the world.
How long has this been going on, in your view, the use of big data to inform policing practices?
Well, in some ways, data has always been collected by police, but it's really the fact that we have better computer systems and new predictive analytics that's changing it. And so we're seeing an evolution that begins slowly because the technology is slow, but is rapidly increasing as new companies, new startups, and new technologies are being developed almost by the day and certainly by the year. So I think we're talking about the last 7 or 8 years where we've really seen the growth, and it is happening, as many new technologies do, exponentially. We're seeing new and newer technologies every day.
Let's look at the normative aspect. What are both the positive and the negative aspects of big data in terms of helping police solve crime and enhance accountability? Because you talk about the seamier side or some of the shortcomings or negative impacts as well.
In many ways, I feel that it's important to be somewhat agnostic about the data. The data is the data. It's technology that allows police to do different things differently, maybe get some efficiencies in certain policing practices, but there are also costs. So take, for example, place-based predictive policing. Place-based predictive policing is the ability to crunch past crime data, like the place of crime, the time of crime, the location of crime, maybe some other variables. So, you know, Fridays are paydays, so robberies go up. When it rains, the weather might cause people to go out because bad guys don't like getting wet. And you have the reality that you can take all this information and literally try to predict or forecast a particular crime at a particular location. So it's cloudy with a chance of murder, right? And then police go there, and they go there to deter the potential crime. On one hand, you can say, well, that seems like a bunch of like smoke and mirrors and magic and doesn't work. But there is some theory behind it. On the other hand, you can say, how is that going to shape where police go? Which of these communities are going to get targeted? Are you going to see police in poor communities and communities of color? Are you going to see the numbers justifying patrol patterns that might be unfair to certain communities? And those are the real questions that arise, even in something that's relatively simple as the patrol area of policing. And just so you're clear, there are patrol officers who wake up in the morning in these jurisdictions that use predictive policing and are literally given a sheet of paper with the maps of where they're supposed to go stake themselves. And some of the more sophisticated places, their computer screens on their squad car change color as they drive through, say, a high burglary area or a high aggravated assault area. And so they're seeing the reality of crime and predictions in real time as they're driving through. And on one hand, that's clearly going to shape how they see the community. On the other hand, we didn't really have rules about where they were going to patrol beforehand. So maybe it's an okay thing. Maybe there's a sense that if you are just nudging police to the right place at the right time, perhaps this is actually an efficiency, an improvement. And if you talk to police chiefs, they'll say, look, we can do more with less because we're being smarter on crime.
Let me turn to my colleague Chris Simpkins for a question.
And I've witnessed that. I've been around several law enforcement agencies in ride-alongs, including here in the District of Columbia, where they have targeted neighborhoods where they recover the most guns. And the task force I was riding along with was to recover weapons. So they use technology to go to specific neighborhoods looking for weapons. But I'm wondering, Andrew, what other types of data might police be collecting?
Well, you know, I think the most problematic development from a law enforcement perspective is happening in Chicago right now. Chicago has what they call a heat list, a list of individuals they believe are most likely to be violent. It's literally algorithmically derived. You get a score 1 to 500, and it results in the police occasionally knocking on your door or surveilling you. But it can mean literally a knock on your door by a senior law enforcement official and maybe a social worker and someone from the community to tell that young person, look, you're at risk of violence or to be shot, candidly, and you need to turn your life around. And that is obviously disconcerting because there is a targeting mechanism going on. It's clearly a measure of social control. At the other hand, it is a form of public health. This young person is more at risk of violence or getting involved in violence. So maybe the warning, you know, sort of in a scared straight model makes sense. The difficulty to me is this is happening through data and without a whole lot of public oversight. The fact that we're asking these questions now is the first time people are really asking these questions, and we need to be asking more of them. Because as you say, having ridden along with the police, this is changing what police are doing, where they're going, which communities they're targeting. And if there isn't public accountability figuring out that this is okay or this is acceptable or even a debate among the community, it just happens. And we need to be starting to ask those hard questions.
Now, Andrew, one of the aims of your book, you say, is to look at the dangers of black data arising at this moment in history. So please define for us what you mean by black data.
My book basically tries to show that all big data policing has a black data problem. And by black data, I mean three related things. One, there's a transparency problem. It's opaque. This magic black box that's trying to answer these questions can't be seen inside. We don't know the algorithms. We don't know the data. We can't figure it out. It's also black because the data is racially encoded. It is racially encoded with the history of policing in America, which is in many big cities a history of racial bias. If you take Chicago right now, the DOJ Civil Rights Division in 2017 wrote a very long report about the endemic, systemic, real racial bias all the way through Chicago police. So if part of the data inputs are arrests by Chicago police, some of that bias is going to be sort of laundered through the data. So you have this black problem there. It's also black because it's distorting, right? We have a law in the United States, the Fourth Amendment in our Constitution, that was really based in a small data world, right? And now big data is changing, and it's changing how police see their communities, see the people in their communities. And we haven't, as a legal system, as a court, figured out a way forward. And so it's distorting in that way. So all those three realities are part of the black data problem. In addition to the fact that part of the reason this has caught on, it's kind of sexy. It's this cool new black thing. Everyone wants to be smarter on crime. Everyone wants to get the next new thing. And it's this black, sleek idea that, hey, I got a new solution to the age-old problem of crime and policing, which is a new technology, a predictive policing technology. Don't worry, we solved the problem.
But you're worried about black data, so to speak, about the impact on more vulnerable communities, marginalized communities, correct?
Yeah, I'm worried that we aren't even seeing the black data problem. We are adopting these technologies for a whole host of reasons, and people aren't asking the questions for a couple reasons. One is policing in America is very fragmented, it's very localized, right? There's something like 18,000 different police departments in America, and it's very hard to keep track of what your local police is doing, which surveillance technologies they've bought. We know that a lot of policing is focused on particular communities, and some of that's political, some of it is historic, some of it is systemic. And we're not asking the question of, are these technologies being used in a way that is sort of reifying the bias that we're afraid is part and parcel of policing? And we're just not asking those questions. And I think we have to be, because if we're going to adopt these technologies, we need to have thought through the real potential problems before we pay taxpayer dollars on them.
Andrew, how can we create a plan where data and other technology in the United States is used to track incidences of police brutality and deadly force encounters?
There's a whole chapter in the book called Blue Data. And by Blue Data, I want to show that we can actually turn this whole architecture of surveillance that we've built for citizens on police, right? To improve police accountability, to improve training. We have body cameras and surveillance cameras that are watching the streets, but they're also actually watching police officers. We have GPS where you can actually track where police officers go, and perhaps just as importantly, where they don't go. We have predictive analytics that in the same way they can predict the person who's supposed to be violent, can also predict which officers might be more at risk of violence. They also have found with domestic violence situations that if they only sent one or two officers, it tended to sort of increase the potential for a violent encounter with a domestic abuser. But if they sent a whole host of officers, they actually quieted the scene. And so they've got these insights from looking and doing the same kind of number crunching, predictive analytics, that they do when they're trying to identify the places of crime or the people involved in crime. But here they were looking at officer risk and saying, which are the at-risk officers? So we could take the exact same technologies and apply it to police. The political reality is we sometimes don't have that political courage to do so.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Andrew Ferguson, the author of the newly published book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. I'm Carol Castiel, along with senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a big shout out to loyal listener and artist Emmanuel Asamoah, also known as Biggie Bills from Ghana, currently living in Cape Town. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page, as did Biggie. Well, now back to our special guest, Andrew Ferguson, author of The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. What about on the international level? Now, we're talking about the rise of big data policing here, mostly in the United States, but to what extent is it a trend internationally?
It is a growing trend internationally. There's an amazing new documentary called Pre-Crime that's releasing soon that showcases how the predictive analytics that is happening in the U.S. is also happening in the U.K. It's happening in France. It's happening in Germany. And people are starting to pay attention that this is truly an international phenomenon because the data collection, the data technologies are international. And it's attractive to police wherever you are. And so this is, I think it's probably grown more in the United States and grown faster and developed in the United States. But it's coming everywhere.
Chris.
President Obama had his task force, 21st Century Policing, and one of their recommendations was in order to achieve external legitimacy, law enforcement agencies should involve the community in the process of developing and evaluating policies and procedures. And I guess that would include the data they use. How important is it to involve communities in what is going on inside these police departments, as well as the data it collects and helping people understand how they are using that and for what reasons?
It's critical. It's fundamental. Surveillance is a democracy problem, and we're not really engaging. At the end of the book, I essentially propose that we should have annual or more than that surveillance summits where communities are given the opportunity to ask their chiefs, ask the mayors, ask the local leaders, what are you using our taxpayer dollars on in terms of surveillance? And does it work? How do you know it works? What's the data that you have that you're putting in? How is it affecting your officers? And if you can't ask those questions and can't get good answers, maybe we shouldn't be using these technologies because there's an opportunity cost. It means, you know, not spending more money on education or not spending more money on officers' raises for or more officers, right? We are choosing to do it for a certain reason. And we need to have these moments, accountability moments. And they're real questions that the leaders of the local community have to answer, or they shouldn't be using these technologies.
Well, that leads me to ask you, Andrew Ferguson, in the wake of the shooting of unarmed black men here in America, we've had so many incidents, too many to count. And one of the solutions or one of the recommendations was we need more community policing. Now, community policing sort of sounds quaint in a sense compared to the use of big data policing. Nonetheless, where does community policing, diversifying police forces around the country, deploying police officers to communities, allowing them to get to know communities in a sort of a very old-fashioned way of preventing crime. Where does community policing fit into all of this?
I think it's a different approach. Obviously, it could be data-driven if you wanted it to be, but I think it's a different sort of mindset and a different philosophy of policing. And one of the realities of data-driven policing is that it kind of removes the officers from the community, where they see the community through the lens of data, through the lens of, is this a high-crime area, is this a high-crime person or whatever, a high-risk person? And that changes. I think it distorts in a way that may cut against some of the community policing principles.
And to me, that doesn't sound like a very good idea. I mean, it sounds like big data policing somehow contradicts the need for local community policing, which we've come to understand is very important in order to thwart or prevent these terrible tragedies that we've seen of police unnecessarily, perhaps, or using disproportionate force vis-a-vis communities, particularly communities of color.
You know, as a matter of policy, I completely agree. I think what's interesting is that the rise of big data policing comes in response to the tension, outrage, and sometimes protesting in communities of color about policing. And recognizing that tension, police chiefs and administrators needed to sort of turn the page. And one way you could turn the page was to say, oh, don't worry, all of that human error, human bias, human policing problems that you were concerned about, that's going to change because we're not going to be objective. We're going to follow the data. We're going to let data guide us, and that will somehow remove us from the human side of it. When, of course, if you think closely about that idea, it's not true, right? Because, of course, the data is being collected by human police officers. It's being inputted by human administrators. And all of it is going to just sort of sanitize the potential bias that exists if you're not conscious of it. And so it has been a good talking point, but I don't think it necessarily really addresses some of the real concerns that some of this data replicates the bias we know does exist, implicit and explicit, on the streets of the U.S.
Well, after listening to you, it doesn't seem to me that the two are mutually exclusive. That is, the use of big data to inform policing practices and encouraging, advocating more community policing. Police officers still need to be part of the community, get to know the community, have more diversity in parts of this country. That can only be helpful. The two probably can work somehow hand in hand.
They could. You know, so one of the more interesting examples comes out of risk terrain modeling in Atlantic City. So risk terrain modeling is run by two risk terrain modeling. It's a technology that's created by two Rutgers criminologists. And they went to Atlantic City and they were looking at where the violence was going on. And they said, look, we can find three factors and we can show you where the violence is. Those factors are convenience stores, laundromats, and abandoned lots. And you would say, what on earth are the connecting points between that? I said, well, this is actually how drug deals go on. People go to the convenience store, which is open and public, and say, hey, where can I get drugs? They send you to the laundromat where you give them the money, and you're redirected to go to the abandoned lot to pick up your drugs. And that's, of course, where your violence meets you, right? And so they told the police this in Atlantic City. And initially, there was reluctance. Like, we don't believe this. And they said, no, here's the data. And then when they showed that this actually could be predicted and they could do it, they said, you know what we should do? We should change the abandoned lot. We should actually fix up the place of the danger. And if we change the environment of that lot, we will change the criminal patterns. And in fact, that worked and crime went down. And those kinds of intersections can be that. Now, to your point, that isn't really a policing strategy. That's a community strategy. That is a let's talk with the mayor and other leaders strategy. Let's look at whether predictive analytics can be used to identify crime places and patterns and people, but doesn't necessarily require a policing response. And there's a whole chapter in the book called Bright Data, which says, you know, maybe the problem of predictive policing is the policing part. Maybe the predictive analytics of figuring out where there might be crime and who might be involved is a good thing, but let's fix it not with policing, but with social services, with education, with interacting with the individuals and the places that are at risk by fixing those with the ways we know can work.
Economic development, job creation.
problem is it has always become policing because that's where the funding comes from. That's where the procurement comes from. That's how it begins, that they're sort of intertwined because the police are buying the technology for policing.
Police say that they like the idea of expanding research and data collection at its necessity to knowing what works and doesn't work. But how careful do we have to be about data collection, supervision, and accountability in making sure that we're protecting the rights of all involved during police encounters, not only the person who may be pulled over, but the police officer?
So I think we have to be very careful because data is messy and it's very hard to audit it. It's very hard to cleanse it. It's very hard to sort of use it or make it usable in a way that's helpful. We are a country that is notoriously bad at collecting certain kinds of data. And as you mentioned earlier, the initiative by President Obama and the Justice Department and other entities to sort of start collecting police data was the first. Like, we hadn't seen that before. But it's hard because every single day there are police out there doing their jobs and essentially collecting more information. And we don't have the resources and or currently the political will to be able to make that data incredibly useful. We've seen some academics, Stanford and other places, do amazing work with starting to collect this data and sort of build off the innovations of the Obama administration and the task force. But there hasn't been a push in the recent year under the Trump administration, and there hasn't been the funding to really push this forward. And there should be, because we can do more if we collect more information and if we're careful about that information. We actually technically have the ability to do this. We actually can use data well. We can be careful, but it just costs a lot of money. And right now, we haven't invested that kind of money in using data for good.
And Andrew Ferguson, we're now in the Trump administration, and Mr. Trump has always championed police officers, law enforcement, and there's sort of more tension now than there was before because we're trying to, on the one hand, certainly defend and advocate for law enforcement, but at the same time, you know, there are the victims, unarmed black men or others, or people being pulled over for, you know, small reasons, and then somehow it escalates and the victim gets killed. The victim usually is a person of color. How do you see going forward, particularly under the Trump administration and under the Department of Justice, which is also certainly championing law enforcement, how do you see the trend going forward, trying to reconcile the need to, yes, defend law enforcement, but also the victims thereof?
I think we're going backwards. I mean, I think that we had been moving under the Obama administration to a smart on crime approach, which had its own problems and its own real tensions that could be addressed. But we were trying to recognize where crime comes from, how it affects. And you saw great leadership from chiefs who had bought in. It wasn't a top-down approach. It was local law enforcement in partnership with the federal government trying to change and rethink how policing could work, recognizing a lot of the strategies were sort of self-defeating. We have seen, if not a rejection, apathy toward that approach. And the hope is that local law enforcement officials and local law enforcement administrators and chiefs who actually understand that that is a better way to approach crime might still be able to move forward in a local level. But they're not going to have the federal government behind them because the federal government at this moment does not seem to be interested in smart on crime. They want to be tough on crime, but not necessarily smart. And I think the recognition of people who have been advocating for change is that the only hope is to continue the progress that had developed at the local level.
And what about the trend previously toward the militarization of the police force? That was another criticism coming out of all of these tragedies that we've seen, killings, and then there's the backlash, of course, against police officers, many of whom are victims of revenge, perhaps not justifiably. Do you see a trend against the militarization of the police forces today, and what is the relationship between arming of police forces and the militarization and big data policing?
So I think, again, we're going backwards. You know, there was a recognition that it might not be helpful to community policing to have your officers look like soldiers in the, you know, community. And we have seen the Trump administration essentially reject that and want to move forward. There is an interesting connection, right? Most of the technologies we're talking about in terms of surveillance technologies, in terms of predictive analytics, actually began in the military world, in the intelligence world. Many of the technologies literally come from the intelligence community of tracking, you know, terrorists are now being used to track gangs, predictive analytics.
tactics that were being used to identify particular areas of danger being used for areas in the U.S., and surveillance technologies that can fly over cities and film the entire city, right? That came out of our military. And so we're seeing a militarization in sort of a soft sense, because we don't see it as sort of technology, but it's the same technology that was developed for our military and our intelligence community that's now being adopted and applied for local law enforcement.
And like you said, it's not bad in and of itself. It's just that it can't be done exclusively to the detriment of other measures, whether community policing, economic development, and other preventative measures to prevent crime.
I see big data policing as a civil rights issue, right? Because surveillance is a civil rights issue because it affects different communities differently. It affects communities of color differently. Where we are applying those surveillance technologies are, guess where? The poorest communities and the communities of color, people without a voice to say, maybe we don't want it. And I don't think we see surveillance as a civil rights issue. I think that we see them as separate issues. And I think we should. I think we should recognize that all of the tensions and problems that we have seen and we have fought over the decades for are still there. They're in new form. They're in a fancy new black box form, but they're still real, and they still deserve people arguing for accountability and transparency and fairness and mechanisms to ensure that we can feel okay that this is something that we as a community adopted because we think it helps public safety as opposed to sort of just creates a new form of social control.
I've done reporting in African-American communities around the country where residents have seen this type of surveillance, cameras being placed on top of poles to overlook the neighborhood with sound monitoring sensors that can triangulate where possible gunshots are coming from. The police advocate that this is a way to respond and follow up with investigations that lead to convictions and deadly shootings and this type of thing. But people in the community that I have talked to say, well, it's fine to collect the data and it's fine to put a camera up on a pole and watch my community for 24 hours. But that's not going to change the thinking of how officers respond and making sure that officers respond in a non-judgmental way. How can data help that with training and getting officers to think differently when they respond to situations?
Yeah, it may be the case of the type of data you're collecting. So right now, if you think about this incentive systems for officers of what they get rewarded for arrests or convictions or their contacts with civilians. They're not rewarded for how the community thinks about them. My fear is that the data can drive police in ways that they're not even thinking about, that they might be given incentives to go target certain people because the data told them to go target those people without thinking that by doing that, they are creating distrust and they're creating tension in communities. And maybe if you could create other metrics to reward officers for being part of their community, for being respectful, you might actually change some of that dynamic. The same way the surveillance cameras that are in those communities are capturing how police interact with individuals. But rarely are they used for training purposes. Rarely are administrators saying, you know, we got a complaint about, you know, how you were on that block. And we went back and we got the tape. And we looked at it. In fact, you know, you were kind of rough on them, right? This is not the way you should be behaving. And we don't think about surveillance as surveilling police for training purposes. We don't think about improving police through surveillance. We only think about it as surveilling the community and the communities where crime occurs. And we could change that mentality, recognize the information exists if we had the political will to want to use it.
Political will being the key term here.
There's no question that the push toward blue data will create police resistance. Police don't want to be surveilled. In fact, one of the more ironic comments is when you tell them, look, we're going to sort of analyze your background to see if you're more at risk for violence and these incidents, they'll be, oh, no, that's so unfair. What do you mean? I haven't done anything yet. That's exactly what you're doing to communities. That's exactly what you're doing to blocks and individuals. If you think it's unfair, think about how it might be to a poor person of color who gets a knock on the door and doesn't understand why. And showing that reaction and maybe showing their reaction might get people in dialogue about why this kind of predictive analytics is scary, it is troubling, and it needs to be done very carefully. And right now, it's just not being done carefully.
So your book is a wake-up call, an alert.
It is. The technologies are distorting how police do their jobs and how communities interact with police, and we're not paying attention.
The book is The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. The author, Andrew Ferguson, he's a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. Andrew, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on your terrific book.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. Joining me on the program was senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.